Blog Talk Radio.
Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com. What's going on, Owen?
Oh, we're doing our thing over here and such.
Okay.
Oh, shut up. We're in the midst of breeding season, and then we got a show that I'm planning for Saturday, and then it's one of those times where I've spoken about this before. When you get a table at a show, people tend to come out of the woodworks, and, you know, you have to be sparing with what you can bring. So I've already promised half the table to Ben, which is no problem. And, of course, you know you can throw anything you want on the table. But now I got people over here asking me to throw stuff on the table. I got people over there asking me to throw stuff on the table. I got some kid from the neighborhood coming up to the house with a ball python going, "Can you sell this for me?" And I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "I don't even know you. How do you get the hell out of here?" It's, you know, it's one of those things. So we're trying to figure out what displays to bring and which animals to bring, which babies to bring, because we're running low on babies. So I don't want to sell out of everything and then not have any babies to bring to Tinley. Even though, hey, if I wouldn't mind doing that. And not have any, because then the weekend after Tinley, we have a 3-day show, and not have any babies for that, I'd be screwed. So it's one of those things.
Interesting. Yeah, that's pretty funny that people are just knocking on your door randomly and sell my snake for me, please.
It happens.
These
things do happen. So,
well, tonight we have Dr. Shane Whitaker coming on to start our probably many episodes of Ask the Vet. And basically, we're going to focus on, various type of vet-related topics that I thought would be a good aspect to get somebody that is actually a doctor and would be able to tell us the way that we're supposed to do it. Not only that, it's Dr. Shane Whitaker from Quality Serpents, and he keeps snakes. So,
oh my God!
You know, it's kind of a good deal. So. I don't know about you, but I've heard sometimes that, there's some vets that don't really work with exotics, so they don't really know, think, I forget who I was talking to, but they said that they knew more than the vet about the particular animal, but.
Sometimes that happens if you have to, I've been in cases where I need to get some drugs or something for an RI or something like that. And I have to take it to an e-vet because my vet's out of town or something like that. And you have to go and just get the vet to prescribe what you need that you know you need. And sometimes you're walking in there and the vet's like, "So what kind of snake is this?" And it's like, "Oh, for the love of Christ." Well, it's a carpet python. And then you have to walk, basically hold their hand and walk through it. Now, most vets, when it comes down to that, they're very, very nice about that. They understand that this isn't their, you know, expertise. It's when you get the ones that they're a vet and they should know all this, or like, oh, no, you can't tell them what to do. You're just the patient. Shut up. That's when you have some problems. But
right.
It's refreshing to have a vet that knows what they're talking about.
Yeah,
knows the species.
Yeah, I've heard him on various other radio podcasts, reptile podcasts, and yeah, he has a good deal of information. And the thing that I like most is that he's willing to share it. I know over on his website he has a page where, you know, he takes questions that he can
awesome.
Try to answer. And, you know, obviously, you know, I guess you have to diagnose the snake to actually look at the snake or reptile or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can sort of point in the right direction, and that's sort of the idea of tonight. And we're just going to go through point by point, and, you know, as I got quite a list here to go through, and we might not hit it all tonight, and obviously then we're going to have to revisit, so which is cool
of
with
course.
Me. So, I mean, I'd talk to him once a month if I could. You know what I mean? So all that kind of information helps. But before we get him on, we got some very upsetting news this past
yeah.
week in the Moralia world. Rico Walder, who has been on the show before, and what a
yeah.
great guy.
Mm-hmm.
I met him quickly down in Tinley when this past October, and man, just what a great guy. But unfortunately, he was diagnosed with brain cancer. And, you know, it seems like I know he posted up an update tonight, and he seems to be in good spirits. And, you know, I guess he's trying to make the best of the situation. And,
that's
you
all
know,
he can do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wish him the best. And, you know, for anybody that's interested, I put up a zebra jag female that I have from 2012. She was from a diamond jag sib to a zebra jag. I have her listed at $1,500. I'm putting her up, and if you buy her, you get a really cool carpet python, and everything will go to Rico. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, we help Rico out. You get a cool carpet. It's kind of a win-win.
Right.
So, if you can't, you know, if you can't do that, Chris Behoff, he put up his Brettel jag, and that sold.
Right.
And I want to say that was maybe $400, and he got that, so that went to Rico. But so far, they've raised $22,675, and it's still growing. But I posted
good.
A link up on the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page, and after I'm done, I'll put it up on our website. But
excellent.
It's www.giveforward.com/Rico Relief Effort. And you can go
right.
over there, and you can, you know, even if you donate $5 or whatever you can afford to give, you know, help him out, because he's
every
really
little bit counts.
Sure. He's really a great
mm-hmm.
guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, I guess we can officially announce this. You know, we always go back and forth. We have the auction every year at Carpet Fest, which
yes.
is Northeast Carpet Fest. It's May 18, 2013 in Maryland, sponsored by Reading Reptile Breeders. And we are going to do 100% of the auction of everything that's raised will go to Rico. So
right.
I thought that was good.
And, it's definitely good to see the outcry or the outpouring of support through the Morelia community. I know that you put up an animal. I know Chris put up an animal. I put up a tiger for $200 with 100% of the proceeds going to Rico. Later on this week, Chris and I are going to be putting up one of our scrub pythons for $500 that 100% will go to Rico. Also, I know that Howard down in Reading Reptile Breeders is donating. He's pledged 100% of his earnings for the rest of the year, for I guess until they've stopped collecting funds to go to Rico, which is amazing. So I'm proud of us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Do you have the poll of the week in front of you? I'm going to see.
I do.
You do? Okay. Why don't you start that, and I'm going to.
You go ahead and you talk. I'll just sit here with the people. So it's looking like that the poll of the week, that there were two polls. I don't know. It's kind of a craziness with all these polls. But one of the polls, or poll number two, which is, what's your city banned in Morelia? What? do you do a city if you live in banded all Morelia? Oh, now the one question is, what would you do if your city or town banned all Morelia? Apparently there is start packing up ASAP, collection sale, or keeping off the radar. Speaking for myself, in the town that I live in, where you're only allowed to have 8 constrictors of over 6 foot, I do kind of somewhat keep off the radar. But in my opinion, if I lived in a city that was going to completely ban them, I would start looking for a new place to live. The other poll is, do you keep pedigree on your carpet pythons? Now, the one that's kind of edging out right there is, it looks like everything was all kind of tied up until someone voted, and now, no, I have information on the parents, and that's good enough, is winning. And I'm kind of part of that. I have information on the parents, and that's pretty much it. I try to keep the lineages going, but I won't let something like a dead end stop me from breeding a carpet python that I can pretty much gauge as pure coastal or pure jungle or whatever. So,
yeah, I'll tap in here real quick. I don't know if you, if you hit on, as far as the, did you hit on the payment plans?
No, I didn't see that one. There's too many damn polls.
Yeah, I know. You can check out all these polls on over on the Morelia Python forums. But it seems like that's kind of the been the thing as of late, is the polls. But the big one, I don't know if you threw the plug out there to Chris, but Chris Behoff, he does the CB Reptile poll
Chris
of the week.
No plug.
Yeah, every week. And the one he had is about, are you a fan of payment plans? Well, me personally, I pretty much spend the last 5 years on a payment plan. And
so I have to be a fan of them.
I'm a huge fan of it. I got to be honest, I can see where people would run into trouble. Personally,
and here is where I can chime in. It is, I hate them.
Well, personally, I think as far as the, you know, you would want somebody that's a customer like me. I mean, I, you know,
yeah, well,
if I'm making a payment, I'm making that payment every month. I've agreed to what I'm going to be paying. And, you know, I honor that. It's kind of like a free line of credit, so to speak. You know,
I
guess with the, you know, a no interest line of credit, I should say. And, you know, I guess when you're dealing with high-end stuff, you know, because over the past couple of years, I've got some pretty high-end animals, and it's not like, you know, I don't know, I'm not a millionaire or something where I just have like endless cash flow, but I can, you know, afford to make a certain payments a month, and I work that out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what, Paul Harris has been super great about it, and you know, we've built up a relationship, and I think that's kind of the other part of it. We built up a relationship to where he, you know, trusts me, and he knows that I'm good for what it is. But I think that's kind of important when you're developing that relationship with, if you're the breeder or if you're the buyer. I mean, you know, you're going to hope to maybe one day return and buy something else from said breeder. So, you know, it's good to have a relationship with that. I know Will
right.
Bird was the same way. I had real good relationship with him, and you know, I don't know. I think it just makes a good name for yourself if you honor what you're saying. I mean, as far as me personally giving a payment plan, I think I'm going to be honest.
You are going to have to. It's just the way you're. I'm telling you right now. Here's where payment plans are killer. See, I'm actually rewriting my payment plans because they've been driving me crazy. Normally, right now with Rogue, you pay half of the total value, and it'll hold it for 90 days. But what I'm finding out is that stretch of 90 days is ridiculous. It's just to hold on to an animal that somebody has dropped, a $350 animal, someone's dropped $150, and now sitting in my room eating my food here. It's just like, are you, for 90 days, and they don't pay until the last second. That's ridiculous. Or you get people where they'll give you – a lot of times people ask, well, if I give you $50 here, and then next week I'll give you $50 here, and the next week I'll give you $50 here. That's all fine and good. But, see, I have to stop agreeing to those things. So it's we're rewriting the payment plans. You can't really give people that long of a stretch. Now, of course, if this is a return customer, if this is a person that has spent money with you before, that has been a joy to deal with as a customer, you're going to bend over backwards to let them do what they want because you've had good business relationships with these people. You know, it's that's why if I start buying animals from somebody, the price it's listed, sure, pay it, done. And I won't start trying to negotiate prices or payment plans until it's like the fourth animal I bought from this person. So
yeah, I think they brought up a good point that if you're doing a payment plan, you don't haggle over a price. I mean, you know.
Oh, hell no.
You're kind of
you don't
like,
sit there and go, I'll do $350. Can I do a payment plan? I'm like, no.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things.
Yeah, I don't think there's any escape from it as far as what I'm doing. So, I'm fine with it as long as the terms and everything is worked out and we're good.
Can I have albinos on the payment plan?
Yeah, sure. For you, yeah.
Sweet. Yeah, thank you.
Pedigree, my... No.
You don't even get to answer that question. We all know you have your magic book that has leads back to when they were, like, shipped over on a boat with sails from Australia.
Nod to the Chondro community. I think they do a fabulous job with
the
lineages and all that kind of stuff. And I'm kind of going that direction with the carpets. I think that, number one, most importantly, is because I have pure subspecies and I also work with intergrades.
Mutt.
Sure, however you want to call it. but I want to be able to make sure that, the person can feel confident that the animal that I'm giving them is what they're buying. And, you know, I think that just comes down to a trust. I know last year everybody that bought a snake from me got a disc, and on that disc had pictures of the parents, pictures of them coming out of the eggs. What else? A little kind of family tree type of thing. And, hey, maybe that's a little...
You know what I'm thinking right now? Is I know that you didn't give all the people pictures of them coming out of the eggs because some of them were hatched here. Sorry.
Yeah, but I don't think I sold any of those. Well, yeah, true.
Never mind. I retract my statement.
That's my thoughts on that.
It's a good idea. I mean, if I wasn't so lazy, I'd probably do the same thing. So.
I think I saw that in the ball python world. I saw somebody was doing something to where it was they were talking about hets, and they wanted to make sure that the animal that they were buying was a het. So what they did is they had it's almost like a pedigree type of paper that was laminated that went in when they shipped it, and you know you got this thing that said that you bought it from such and such breeder. Here were the parents, so you're kind of guaranteed in a het. You know, if you go to turn around and you go to sell that animal, I think that's going to make it a little more valuable.
Yeah. Well, I remember last year at Carpet Fest when you got that Biak. What'd you get?
The Biak, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Biak, yeah. Yeah, the Biak, that was the only snake that came with, like, a baggie that came with it that had, like, a disc and a bunch of stuff with it that was the pedigree for the animal. You basically got, like, a whole slew of stuff along with the Biak. So
yeah, exactly.
I thought that was pretty nice.
That's kind of where I got the idea. So
you got the Biak just to get those discs, didn't you?
Yeah. I don't think I have anything else to hit on. I'd like to get Shane on here and get rocking.
Let's bring on the doctor.
Rocking and rolling. Hey, Shane, welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
Thanks for having me, guys. Glad to be here.
No problem.
Of course. So, Shane, we normally go through a few things before we go down the list, can you just give us a little bit of a brief thing of tell us a little bit about yourself and what led to you becoming a vet?
Yeah, this is one of those. It's one of those things I grew up knowing I wanted to do something that made me feel important, and I started out thinking maybe I was going to be a physician, and quickly decided that the sight of human blood kind of makes me sick, and so I decided that was out.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly enough, my life is. The way it's turned out, most of my time is spent doing surgery, and so I spend most of my time looking at animal blood, and it doesn't bother me at all. But human blood does make me sick, and I just can't do that. But I wanted to do something where I felt like I could make a difference in people's lives, and it just turned out that veterinary medicine was where I ended up. And
awesome.
I don't know that I have a typical background story of most veterinarians. You know, if you ask that question to most veterinarians, you're going to get, I love animals my whole life, and I always knew I wanted to do something with animals, and that I wouldn't say that. I seem to have some kind of a, just kind of second nature to me to work with them. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know that, it's not one of those things where I grew up and knew from the time I was 5 years old that I was going to be a veterinarian. I didn't really decide that I was going to be a veterinarian until, you know, really until I started college and just started thinking about where I was going to go and just
okay.
sort of wound up there.
That's good. Where'd you go to school?
I started out at a little community college in Kentucky. It's called Leeds College. I did the bulk of my undergraduate work at the University of Kentucky, and I went to vet school at Auburn University.
Cool. So what led you into focus on reptiles?
Well, that started way before the veterinary medicine stuff. Probably before, let's see, I'm going to say somewhere around 88 or so. A friend of mine in high school, actually he was a friend of mine way before high school, but mm-hmm. while I was in high school, a friend of mine, he started keeping some reptiles, and really before that, you know, I hadn't really done much with them. Of course, I'd caught the occasional frog or lizard or garter snake or something outside, most kids
mm-hmm.
would do, and kept some in my room and, you know, that kind of thing. My mom wasn't totally opposed to it, but she wasn't really happy about it either. She wasn't going to really let me keep a bunch of stuff in the house. So, But as it turned out, a friend of mine had a lot of stuff, and I got really interested in it through him and ended up sort of partnering with him. And so we kept stuff at his house and sort of got into it that way. And that, like I said, that was probably in 88. And since then, I've really only been without reptiles in my house for a few years. When I graduated vet school in 2000, I wasn't quite sure what the career was going to get me into and wasn't sure how much time I was going to have, and so I sold everything, sold my entire collection in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
About 2003 or so around there, I decided I can't live without that. So I started buying stuff back and started rebuilding the collection then. So there's 3 years or so in there where I didn't have anything. But other than those 3 years, I've always had some sort of reptile. So it was pretty much that was a given for me when I went to vet school that I wanted to learn as much as I could about that side of the profession.
Awesome.
Okay, so we're gonna start, I think, the topics as far as vet or keeping animals healthy in captivity. I think the most important part of it is quarantine, and I just wanted mm-hmm. to know what your thoughts are on the importance of quarantine that could avoid possible issues.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. I want to point out that some of the stuff that you guys are going to hit on, I've written a few articles about for the Bush League Breeders Club. And when the newsletter was up on the Bush League
Okay.
I wrote some articles for that newsletter. And so a lot of this stuff, if people want it, I mean, obviously your shows are going to be archived. They can go back and listen to that. But if they want the stuff, they can go to Bush League and dig up some of those newsletters, and a lot of that stuff would be in there.
Okay.
And quarantine is one of those things, so that's why I bring that up. But quarantine for me is pretty simple. It's about four pretty simple, easy steps. And if you follow those four simple things, usually you'll stay out of trouble. So the first thing is I recommend for the first week when you get an animal, you keep the new addition under the conditions as close to what they were before you got them. As long as that's not a problem, obviously. I mean, obviously, what I'm talking about now only applies to healthy snakes. If we're talking about rescues, that's a completely different thing because you can't keep the snake under the old conditions. It was in it. Yeah. So let's just say this only applies for healthy snakes. I recommend for the first week, try to keep them as close to the conditions that they were kept in before you got them for that first week. And then after that, ideally, you would house them in identical conditions to what you're going to keep them after the quarantine period is over. So that first week is sort of the transition time. I think the thing is, it can be too quick of a change can cause some problems. And so best if there is any difference in the husbandry issues that you sort of slowly work through that in the first week or so. Preferably that quarantine area is going to be in a completely different room than your reptile room, but if your room's big enough, then it doesn't necessarily have to be. when I quarantine animals here, sometimes I do it in the same room, sometimes I do it in a totally different room. Kind of depends on the size of the snakes I'm working with and what it is, but it doesn't necessarily have to be in a different room, but it does need to be far enough away that there's no obvious close contact and you're not having to work in the same area with old animals and new additions at the same time. That's sort of the first thing. The second thing is to make sure when you're doing any work in the reptile room that whatever work you do on those quarantine animals, you do that last. So work with all your established stuff first. Get all that done out of the way before you have to touch any of these new animals. That will help you to sort of not anything that might be wrong with those new additions to not spread that to your established collection. And make sure, obviously, that you wash your hands after you get done, in between working with the new additions and the established animals. The third thing is you want to closely observe the new additions and treat any issues that arise during the quarantine period. I don't normally recommend unwarranted preventative treatment. A lot of people think, well, if I get a new addition, I just automatically need to worm it. I need to treat it for mites, and I need to treat it, with antibiotics or whatever. I don't usually recommend that. The thing is, you've got a brand-new animal in a brand-new environment. That by itself, along with shipping or riding in a car, however it got to your house, that's all stressful. And medication can be stressful for animals. And so I don't usually recommend, unless there's a problem and it needs it, I don't recommend treating with any kind of medication. It can, if it's unnecessary, add unnecessary stress to the animals and make the situation worse. I recommend for most snakes, I recommend a 30-day quarantine period. But there are a lot of people who do it a lot longer than that, and a real good argument can be made for making a longer quarantine period than that, and I wouldn't really argue too much about it. The last thing is I recommend not feeding any new additions for a week after you get them. Obviously, again, we're not talking about rescue animals that are malnourished. But for healthy animals, I usually recommend not feeding them for a week. And after that first week, I think it's best to just start feeding them like you were going to feed them after that 30-day quarantine period is over. Really, that's it. It's not that complicated. It's just really about being careful.
Right.
Okay. Is there anything that we should be trying to observe from the snake? Like any tips you could give us as far as things to look for if there could be a possible issue while the snake's in the quarantine?
Yeah, I mean the truth about that is that list is 2 miles long because it could be. I mean, it depends on what's wrong with the snake, right? So, I mean, there's a million problems a snake can have, and everyone has its own symptoms. But obviously, we're going to be primarily looking for the common things. You know, respiratory infections, well, what do you look for a respiratory infection? Well, that's what you're going to be looking for during this quarantine period. What do you look for when a snake has external or internal parasites? Those are the things you're going to be looking for during the quarantine period. Do you want to go over those things now or hit those things as we come to them?
Yeah, we can go to them. Yeah, we can go to them as we come to the various topics. That way,
The simple answer to your question is you're going to be looking for the same things. So the same things during the quarantine period as you would look for any other time for those problems.
Let me ask you this question. What would be the symptoms that the snake would be stressed out? I mean, you know, do you have anything, you know, are you going to see the snake trying to escape all the time? Or are you going to see the snake curled up in the, I mean, I would think that if the snake is hiding and, you know, I would think that would be normal. If it was constantly on the move, wouldn't that sort of show that the snake is stressed? Or what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the thing is we got to approach these things with some common sense and look at what we're keeping. Every animal's different. You know, I would think it would be, for instance, highly unusual for a really secretive animal, pick whichever one you like, a burrowing python, to say, for example. I would say it'd be highly unusual to see that snake out and about all day long looking for a place to get out of his cage, right? At the same time, if you pick a diurnal snake that is used to being out and during the day and roaming around, if that snake is hovered up in a corner, curled up in a ball all day long, that's unusual for him. So it kind of depends on, you just have to, the snake ought to be exhibiting his normal behavior.
So I guess another important point to make would be that if you do the research on the animal ahead of time, you would kind of know what you would be looking for from species to species.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point and one that gets missed quite often. It's pretty amazing to me how many times I see somebody come into my office with a snake who actually doesn't even have a problem. And somebody thinks it's a problem because they don't have any idea what that snake is supposed to be doing. And sometimes the other way around. Sometimes the snake will have a problem and somebody won't realize it's a problem because they don't know what they're keeping. But yeah, I think that's a very good point to make.
All right. So
other things you have to think about with stress, you think about it like this. Now, sometimes a quarantine period can be too short of a time to see the results of stress, because if you think about it like this, snakes, reptiles in general, do everything slow. They eat slow. They reproduce slow. When they get sick, they heal slow. And they get sick slow. And so pretty much everything that they do, they digest their food slow. It's all slow. And that's just the nature of the thing. But what we got to think about is stress really suppresses the immune system. And it just makes them more susceptible to disease. So sometimes stress, if we're talking about a quarantine period sometimes won't be long enough to really show us how stressed an animal was. Sometimes it's after they get out of that quarantine period that we really see the results of it.
Awesome. So now for respiratory infections, RIs, can you explain to us what exactly is going on when a snake has a respiratory infection?
Again, that's a big topic. There's lots of different kinds of respiratory infections, and a lot of them don't look the same. So, but in essence, a respiratory infection is an infection. So, some infectious agent could be a bacteria, virus, fungus. Sometimes it can be cancers. But any kind of infection typically wouldn't be cancer, but sometimes we want cancer in there because it can cause respiratory disease. But typically the infections, viruses, funguses, bacteria, any infection that causes disease in the respiratory tract. The respiratory tract, we're going to include the nasal passages, the mouth, the lungs, and pretty much, you know, lungs and bronchi, that kind of thing, trachea, those kind of things. So any kind of infection that causes disease in those body systems we'll call a respiratory infection. Depending on where that respiratory infection is, whether it's in the lungs or whether it's just in the mouth or just in the trachea, just in the nasal passage, will determine, you know, what kind of symptoms they're showing.
Okay. So what are the signs, what are the first signs of a respiratory infection?
It's going to depend on where this infection is and what kind of infection it is. Oftentimes, the first thing that we notice is some kind of something going on with the mouth. Either the snake holds his mouth open and breathing with his mouth open, or some kind of discharge or something coming out of his mouth. A lot of times you'll see snakes with blowing bubbles. I hear that a lot. Some kind of mucus or some kind of purulent puff-looking material coming from the snake's mouth or his nose. There's a lot of things that people don't notice to look for, and a lot of our, and I'd say our horticulture procedures, I'll call it, has sort of makes it a little more difficult for us. A lot of the natural responses from a snake that have a respiratory infection, we've sort of taken that away from them. And when I say that, you guys are mostly focused on carpet pythons. That's my total focus. But you guys probably don't hinder this probably as much as a lot of the other guys do, because you guys a lot of times have snakes or have enclosures that are tall enough for a snake to lift his body up or get up on a perch or something like that. We keep, you know, most people are keeping colubrids and ball pythons and things like that. We're keeping them in some kind of a rack. And those racks are pretty shallow tubs. And what I'm getting at is a lot of times a snake's natural behavior when they have a respiratory infection will be to position his body in some way to alleviate the problem in his lungs. So either he'll raise the front part of his body up and lean it against something, or he'll hang over a perch and let his head hang down in a dependent way. And the reason for that is because they're trying to get whatever debris is in their lungs and sitting on the respiratory surface, they're trying to get that away so that they can actually get some oxygen exchange in their lungs.
Right.
Sometimes, just like I said, you can see a snake will stand up in a corner and sort of just stand there with his head elevated. It's allowing some of that mucus or some of that debris to sort of drain down off of his lungs, or vice versa, let his head hang down and that stuff drains then out of his mouth. In a rack system, it's hard to see that because they can't do that. That's one of the things I usually tell people when we see actual respiratory infections. I usually tell them, take them out of the rack and put them in something where they can do that, because it helps them. It actually helps them to breathe.
Uh-huh.
I heard before that that one of the problems with Burmese pythons coming down with respiratory infections all the time is that they don't really, in some of the cages that they're kept in, they don't really have the ability to move around a lot, so they're not, I don't know how to explain it, but it's hurting them that they're just kind of just staying there. So is that kind of what you're getting at with?
I think that does give us a good spot to talk about something else. So probably what you're getting at there is what we call thermoregulation. So the snake needs to be able to thermoregulate. He doesn't always 100% of the time want to be at 90 degrees. And he doesn't always 100% of the time want to be at 70 degrees. Sometimes he likes to be 70. Sometimes he wants to be 90. And especially with breeding females, a lot of times they need those temperatures to reproduce properly. And so sometimes depending on what part of the cycle they're on, they're all going to want a certain temperature, and other parts of their cycle they're going to want a different part of different temperature. And feeding is the same way. After a meal, they're going to want to be over on the warm side because they're going to need that heat to digest their food. And when they don't have a meal in them, they might choose to be on the cooler side. The problem is when you put a snake into an enclosure that's too small and he's not able to thermoregulate, you're really stressing him out and suppressing his immune system. And so just makes him much more susceptible to respiratory disease. The other thing about the berms, and really it goes down to smaller snakes than that, the ball pythons, really what it comes down to is heavy-bodied snakes. One of the things that I've been a big proponent of that not many people want to listen to is the difference between back heat and belly heat. I think for heavy-bodied snakes, they're much better off to have back heat for those snakes than for belly heat. The reason is because if you think about the difference between the body mass of a heavy-bodied snake and a slender-bodied snake, it's much easier for a slender-bodied snake to heat his core than it is a heavy-bodied snake. That just makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So what that means is a heavy-bodied snake has to spend more time in that heat than a slender-bodied snake would. If you have a problem with your belly heat, it doesn't have to be a very big problem, just a small hot spot in a heat tape or something like that. Snake has to – he's going to heat his core up because that's the most important thing to him. And sometimes they'll sacrifice their skin to heat their core. The bigger the body on the snake is, the longer he's going to have to sit there to get his core temperature up. I've seen a bunch of times where snakes will come in and they'll have burns. And I'm talking about burns on a snake that's in what we would normally consider a properly heated rack, but has belly heat on it, and the snake's had to sit there for a really long time to get his core body temperature up, and he's ended up burning his skin. That's a lot more difficult to do with back heat. With back heat, you're really relying more on the radiant heat to heat that area of the tub than you are actually the contact surface of the tub where he's sitting on.
Right.
And so that all plays into thermal regulation. But yeah, they definitely need to thermal regulate. It is really, really hard to provide a proper environment for a Burmese python or a reticulated python. They're just big and they need a lot of room. These, a 4-foot cage, a 4-foot vision cage, not going to do it for an adult berm. It's just not going to work. I mean, you can cram him in there. It's not what he needs.
Right.
I got a question real quick. You were talking about core temperatures and stuff. And before we were talking on the show, we've had people, especially it seems with some chondro people, that they're keeping their animals at, say, they're trying to get a core body temperature of 82 degrees. So they're not really even keeping any hot spot at all because they're getting that temperature of 82 degrees that kind of is what the – let me say this, between 75 and 85. What are your thoughts on that with not having heat?
So we're talking about somebody who's keeping their ambient temperatures up around 82?
Yes, in the room.
And not providing heat? But, again, let's just think about it from a logical point of view. Chondros are – I don't even know. Does anybody use that word anymore? We'll call them green tree pythons.
Sure.
Okay. I know that's been controversial before. I'm not sure what people are calling them. But anyway, those guys come from tropical rainforests, right? I mean, they're coming from pretty much, equator-type climate or close to it. Those guys are living in a rainforest, and they're not really doing what a lot of other snakes are doing to thermoregulate. If you think about snakes here in the state, just think about how many people have gone out and, find snakes on the road. They're road hunting, basically. And you see a snake at close to dark, he'll climb out on the road to try to get some heat. He's trying to gather some heat that's collected in that road. Green tree pythons is really his natural habitat. It's not like that. But, they're pretty much living in 78 to 82 degrees temperature all year round. And so I don't really think it's necessary for those snakes to have heat hot spots. And if you keep that core temperature up to, 78, 82 degrees, I think you're going to be fine with those snakes. I think it's really the same. I think you can accomplish the same thing with, say, colubrids. In fact, I keep a very low hot spot in my snake room. I keep my ambient temperature in my snake room 78 to 82 degrees all year round. And on my colubrid rack, my hot spot's 84. So it's only 2 degrees difference at the most, or 4 degrees difference at the most, between my hot spot and my ambient temperature.
Right.
And they don't really need to thermal regulate that much. And you want that core body temperature where it is. I think ball pythons are going to be a little bit different.
Right.
I think there are parts of their cycle where they really want it colder, and there are parts of their cycle where they really want it hotter. Again, I keep my ball pythons in the same room with my colubrids, so my temperature is 78 to 82, but I give them a 90-degree hot spot. I think they just want it a little bit hotter sometime part of their cycle.
Interesting. Sorry, Owen. Go ahead.
No. It was interesting. It was good. So what are some of the precautions that we as keepers can do to try to prevent respiratory infections?
One word, husbandry.
Husbandry, gotcha.
Yeah, so I'm not an egotistical person, so it's not anything about that, but in all the years that I've been keeping snakes, like I said, since 88 or 89, whenever that was, with the exception of 3 years, and I've never had one single snake in my house that had a respiratory infection. And part of that's luck, I'm sure. But I think most of it is just good husbandry, keeping things clean, being careful with quarantine, and keeping everything and keeping parameters right. I see respiratory infections in my practice probably more than any other disease. I see respiratory infections.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, 99.9% of the time, it's husbandry problems. There's a lot of times, I don't want to really put a number on it because if I do, I might be wrong, but there's a lot of times I send a snake home who has a respiratory infection without any medication, and most of the time they get better. And
really?
The reason for that is because I spend a lot of time in an exam room talking to people, asking questions, and I don't make it so that people feel like they're, I don't make them feel stupid. You know what I'm saying? So I try to be professional about it and say, look, tell me about your setup. What kind of cage is it in? What's the temperature on the hot end? What's the temperature on the cold end? Where's this water bowl? And then I try to paint a picture in my mind of how they're keeping this snake. I just try to decide for myself, where did this problem come from? If they go through an entire setup and everything sounds perfect, then my mind starts working on, okay, well, when was the last time you brought some snakes into your collection? And if they haven't brought any snakes into the collection, then I start thinking about, okay, have you got any parasites? You got, things like that. And like I said, 99.9% of the time I'll find something, and we'll find the answer just in a 15 or 30 minute conversation. We'll find the answer to the problem. And then I'll send them home and tell them, you fix this problem and your respiratory problem will go away. And that's usually what happens. That's not every single time, but a big part of that time. That's what happens.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. I do have a question as far as, do you see a rise in the amount of respiratory infections you see during the breeding season as opposed to any other time?
I don't think I do. Two things. Where are you guys located at?
Pennsylvania.
Okay, yeah. So I'm in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Our winters are much less severe than you guys are. Breeding season here is stretched out much farther than it is in the north. Now, I can remember, I grew up in Ohio and some in Kentucky, but most of my teenage years and that were in Ohio. And just the winters up there, it's ridiculous compared to here. When people are closing down schools 3 days before they predict snow here, it's ridiculous. It kills me. You can't get a loaf of bread or a gallon of milk. If they predict, you won't even see a snowflake, and you can't buy a gallon. Anyway, but I think the point is, since the winters aren't nearly as severe, our breeding season is much more stretched out here. In fact, there's some people I know in Florida. I mean, I think it even happens in the north when people have really good controlled temperatures indoors. But breeding season is stretched out all year round, pretty much. So, I mean, the answer to your question is no, I really don't. But I think it's probably because our breeding season here isn't nearly as compressed as it is in the north.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. The next topic I wanted to hit on would be were you done, Owen? I didn't know if you had another question.
The only other one is, what are steps you take?
Go ahead.
The last one was, what are some of the steps a keeper can take to treat a respiratory infection in the snake?
Yeah. Well, a big part of that we already hit on. That's fixing whatever husbandry problem caused the problem to start with.
Right.
And like I said, a big part of the time it's gonna be a husbandry problem. So if we fix that, usually it'll go away. Now, when it doesn't go away, I think that's what your question's getting to. Generally we'll put the snakes on some kind of antibiotics. If somebody brings me a snake and they can afford it, the first thing I want to do is culture something from that snake. Either we'll want to get a culture from the snake's mouth, or we'll want to do a bronchoalveolar lavage. That's where we're going to squirt a little bit of fluid into the snake's trachea and let it go down into the lungs and swish around, and then we're going to suck it back out. And then we'll get a real sample of what's in the snake's lungs. And then we'll send that off for a culture, or what's called a culture and sensitivity, and they'll tell us, you know, what did they grow and also what antibiotics that organism is susceptible to. That's the best way to treat them. Because what happens, here's the thing. That's why I tell people this over and over and over again, and it just seems like beating a dead horse. People don't get it. And every snake that wheezes does not have a Batrel deficiency. It seems like everybody thinks that if a snake wheezes, he has to have Batrel.
Yeah.
It's just not so. So, you know, I use Batrel. I use Batrel in my practice, you know, quite a bit. But it's not the first thing that I reach for usually. Quite frankly, like I said, most of the respiratory infections that I see go home without antibiotics. But the ones I do put on antibiotics, sometimes we'll give them Batrel injections. A lot of times I end up giving them oral antibiotics to give at home. But I think the key is antibiotics. If it's a viral infection, you know, the truth is there aren't any good antivirals out there. Not many good for anything, but especially in the reptile world, there just aren't many good antiviral drugs out there. A lot of times you just end up waiting those things out. Some of those viruses are, you know, really bad viruses. You think about inclusion body disease, you know, that kind of stuff can cause some respiratory issues. You're not going to cure that, obviously. And then the antifungal things, I mean, that's going to amount to antifungal medications. Those things can be hard to diagnose sometimes. For the ones where people can't afford a culture, you know, typically we'll start with something. Usually I'll look at the snake and I'll try to decide for myself as best I can and make an educated guess about what's causing the problem. Typically we can say clear discharges usually are viral things, and those colored discharges, yellow, green, colors, whatever, are usually bacterial infections. Fungal infections can look, yeah, they can look a lot of different ways. But I try to decide for myself, what does this look like? And then I'll just make an educated guess about which antibiotic to start with. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm not.
Right.
And you can't do a culture, though. You're kind of at the mercy of making that educated guess and hoping you're right. But once they have a respiratory infection, if correcting the husbandry thing doesn't work, then you got to go with some kind of antibiotic.
Okay. Did you have any other questions about respiratory infections, Owen, or are you?
I've heard of mostly with respiratory infections, turn up the heat to help out with that, turn down the heat. I've heard increase the moisture, decrease the moisture. Is there anything else you can weigh in on that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Okay, so we'll separate those into two categories. First, we'll talk about the easy one, which is we'll talk about the person who had it wrong to start with. Then we're just correcting. So if somebody had the heat too high or too low, we're just going to correct it, or the humidity, we're just going to correct it and get it back where it should be, and you probably won't have a problem. The harder one is when you got a snake that has a respiratory infection where the husbandry was right to start with. And then you got to decide what to do. Generally, what I tell people is snakes have to have energy to do anything. So they're not like we are. They can't produce their own energy. Obviously, even we have to have energy sources, but by and large, we're producing heat and we're producing our own energy. Well, reptiles are not doing that. They got to have food and they got to have heat before they can do anything. And so I usually do recommend raising the temperatures a little bit. Now, when I say a little bit, I'm talking about if you normally have a ball python and you've got them at your hot spot at 90 degrees, I usually tell people, raise that to 93, 94 degrees. Yeah. And humidity, I'm not a big fan of messing with humidity and when snakes have respiratory infections. Like I said, if it's wrong, then we need to correct it. But if it's right to start with, I'd rather just leave it where it is.
Okay.
It does bring up another good point, though.
Sure. Go ahead.
A lot of people think it's a pretty common misconception that people think that the things that cause respiratory infections are too cold temperatures and too high humidity. The truth is, too high temperatures can cause it, too low temperatures can cause it, too high humidity and too low humidity can all cause it. The reason is because we're stressing the snake out, and stress is really where these respiratory infections are coming from. So anything in the husbandry that's off that causes stress is where this thing's going to come from. These bacteria usually are not some just crazy bacteria that came from outer space. It's usually something that's there already, and we just stressed the snake and allowed this bacteria to overpopulate and cause a problem. So it could be, like I said, any husbandry problem. So it's not necessarily temperatures that are too cold or somebody left the door open and left a draft come in the snake room. So it could be too hot or too dry.
Right. Okay. Anything else, Owen?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
I wrote all that down.
Very good. All right. Well, the I guess this is the scourge of most snake keepers is mites. What are your thoughts on some of the different ways to get rid of mites? Maybe you can hit a little bit about what's actually going on in the life cycle of the mite to maybe give us a clue on how you can fight them, and what are the side effects of some of the chemicals that are on the market that are out there?
Those are all good things. Common stuff. Stuff we have to talk about all the time. So here's the thing. Everybody thinks about the common snake mite, and that's going to be the most common one. The truth is, we've identified over 250 species of mites that parasitize snakes. And so there's lots of different mites. Common snake mite is probably the most common one, but there are lots of other ones. I've seen a case or two of chiggers. Do you have chiggers in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. Yep.
The little red bugs you get on your skin.
Uh-huh.
I've seen a couple of cases where those things are parasitizing snakes.
Really?
Are mites too. Yeah, those are mites too.
Huh.
The name for that snake mite is Opionisus, and that's the common snake mite. And that's the most common one we're going to see in snakes. And that's the little bitty black bug that most people are aware of. The one thing that people don't know about those things, or a lot of people don't know, is that those things have been proven over and over again to carry a common bacteria that's called Aeromonas. It's one of the most common causes of respiratory infections. We get these snakes parasitizing or these mites parasitizing our snakes and stressing them out to start with, and they're also carrying this bacteria around. That's one of the first places I usually look when I see respiratory infections. If the husbandry's right, I usually look for mites. And a lot of times it'll be mites. We get rid of this mite problem, these respiratory issues will go away.
Okay.
Now, talking a little bit about the life cycle. The life cycle of the mite is not really that complex. And the eggs are laid in the environment, and eggs usually will lay there for about 30 hours. They hatch in about 30 hours, so it's a little less than about a day and a half or so. The life cycle of mite passes through five stages, and each stage requires a blood meal for it to move on to the next stage. So all five stages of that mite has to get a blood meal for it to move on to the next stage. The little black thing that we see crawling around on the mite, that's the final stage, that's the adult stage of the mite. Mites can live as long as 40 days, and some have been known to live for 3 weeks as an adult without taking a blood meal. The reason that's important is when you're understanding the life cycle is because you can leave a cage completely unattended for 3 weeks. If you put a snake back in there, it's going to get mites again because they're still in there. Typically, if you leave a cage uninhabited for 2 months, those mites are going to die. They can't live that long without taking it. But the the other reason that those things are important is the only life cycle stage of that mite that actually lives on the snake pretty much full time is the adult. The rest are in the environment and they'll get on and off. And the reason that's important is because you got to treat the snake and the environment. You can't just treat the snake and expect this thing to go away. We got to treat the environment too.
Mm-hmm.
What was the other question you asked about?
Yeah, just some of the common treatments for mites that are out there, and what's your thoughts on them, and what would you recommend as a treatment for mites?
Yeah, so if you lined up 15 people and said, how do you treat mites and snakes, you'd probably get 15 different answers. And so there's a lot of different things. There's all kinds of home remedies, all kinds of commercial products. Thing is, I try to stay away from recommending one commercial product over another because, believe it or not, even in writing some articles for the Grizzly Breeders Club, I've been some of these commercial people have been mad and don't like me very much. But in this case, I almost thought it's least necessary to tell you what I do, and let me just say. First off, I don't particularly like pyrethrin products. I don't see as many problems in snakes as I do in other animals, but pyrethrins are not the safest thing in the world. There's a lot of products out on the market that are made with pyrethrins, and I'm just not a big fan of them. If that's the only thing that I had, I think we could use them if we're careful enough. We can be careful with them and make them safe enough. But there are other things out there that we can use. Thing is, there's a couple of things. Everybody's heard the term pyrethrin, probably heard the term pyrethroid too. Those are two different things. Pyrethroids are synthetic pyrethrins, and typically they're much safer than the pyrethrins. Pyrethrins are natural products, and the pyrethroids are synthetic products. I used to use a product a lot called Nix. People would come into my practice with snake mites. I would tell them to go to the drugstore and buy this product called Nix. Most snake people have heard of Nix. It's a human head lice product. Nix is a pyrethroid, and it is safer than the pyrethrins. The truth is, you can still run into some problems with toxicity with the pyrethroids. And because there's another product out there that I feel like is much safer and more effective, I just don't recommend it anymore. And like I said, a lot of people still use Nix, and I used it, in my patients for years before I found this other thing, and I never really had any problems. What I do now is I use a product called Fipronil. It's the ingredient in what most people would recognize as this over-the-counter product for dogs and cats. And tick control called Frontline. Frontline comes in two preparations. It comes in a little spot treatment that you can put on the dog's back. It comes in about a little monthly dose thing. It also comes in a spray bottle, and I use the spray bottle.
Okay.
So what I typically tell people to do is use this, and the reason that I recommend that stuff is because it's perfectly safe for animals. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but as soon as I do, somebody's going to come up with a case where it happened and I'm going to have to eat my words, but it's nearly impossible to produce a toxicity in a snake with this stuff or any other animal. One thing that I really like about this is it doesn't penetrate the skin. And so if you put this stuff right on the snake, and it's not going to get into his bloodstream. And the same with dogs and cats. It stays on the outside of the body. It doesn't go through the skin. You don't have to worry about internal toxicity. Can't say the same thing with pyrethrins and pyrethroids. Like I said, you can use those things and be safe, but they are getting inside the snake. There's no way around it.
Okay.
Fipronil stays on the outside of the snake. Typically what I tell people to do is pretty simple. Usually I tell them, take the water bowl out of the cage, leave the snake in there, spray everything down. Spray the snake, spray the environment, spray everything in there down. But you do have to have pretty good ventilation because it does have some alcohol in it. And so you don't cause some respiratory issues if you completely bottle them up. You've got to have good ventilation. But spray everything down. Leave whatever substrate you have in there. The reason that that's important is because there's snake mites in that, it's at some life cycle stages in that bedding. If you try to take that stuff out now, you're just going to be dropping it on the floor, spreading it somewhere else. Leave it in there and kill it. But spray everything down. Wait 10 days. Repeat the process. Take the water bowl out. Spray everything down. Spray the snake down. Spray all the bedding down. The next day, clean all the bedding out. Take it all out and throw it away. Put all new bedding in. Put your water bowl back in. And you're good to go. Typically, you never have any more problems. I've had one case of mites in, let's see, I graduated in 2000, started vet school in 96. So probably since 1992 or so around there, I've had one case of mites in my collection, and that was about 3 years ago. I have zero idea where it came from. I didn't bring anything into the collection in any recent time or anything. I have no idea. But I had them, and I used the stuff that I've been recommending to my clients forever. I used it on my own collection once. I mean, did just exactly what I said. They did it, waited 10 days, did it again, and that's 3 years ago, and never saw another one. And so that's what I recommend. Like I said, I really try to stay away from, you know, endorsing one product over the other. And that's not really what I'm doing now. I know a lot of people that use Preventamite. I know a lot of people that use Nix, and they swear by it, and they don't have any problems. And so I'm not really want to bash anybody for doing that, but that's not what I do.
Okay. What do you as far as the front line? Is that something you can get at like PetSmart or Petco or something
yep.
like that? Or okay,
it's over the counter, and so it's not a prescription. It's just over the counter. So most veterinarians carry it. And typically, PetSmart, Petco, those places carry it too. Typically, you can buy it. Now, I do know some people that have problems finding it. So I'm not sure why in some areas of the country it's harder to find than others, but evidently it is. I have some friends that have big reptile collections, and sometimes they can't find it. I'm not sure why that is. But most areas of the country have it.
Okay, and what are your thoughts on just preventing getting mites in the first place? I know you just said that yours just kind of popped out of nowhere.
Yeah.
You get a new snake into the collection, you know, are you treating that snake when it comes in, or are you just hoping that you don't see them and then bringing it in into the rest of the collection?
So now we have to precede this next statement by whatever advice I give goes right out the window, because I just told you that I got it and didn't have any idea where it came from. So whatever advice I'm about to give you, it sounds like it's pretty worth it. But typically, I think quarantine is the issue. That's why it's important to either keep these snakes in another room or far enough away that that's not an issue. So obviously, snake mites can get out and crawl around. And so if you got things that are in close proximity, you bring in a new snake and he's in the tub right next to one of your established animals, then, you know, obviously they can just crawl right over and get on it. If you got him completely across the room and there's nothing in between except for a concrete floor, you know, a snake mite's typically not going to crawl across 40 feet of concrete floor to get to another snake. He didn't even know it's over there. So
right.
That's typically not going to happen. Or if it's in another room, obviously that's just a wall is another barrier. And then you've got a chance to observe that snake for a while he's in quarantine and look and see if you might have anything. Then also, that's why another reason it's important to make sure you deal with those animals last. Because if he does have mites, then you might be carrying, if you work with him first, you might be carrying them to your established collection since you work with him first and then move on to your other things. Typically, I don't recommend treating snakes for mites while they're in quarantine unless you see them. Because what we talked about before, I'm just not a big fan of treating things that we don't know needs treated. I'm not a holistic type person in general, but I am kind of, you know, if you don't have a reason for it, why do it? Our bodies are not built for synthetic drugs. I use them all the time because they help. But I'm not built for that. If I don't have a reason to put it in my body, I'm not going to. I kind of feel the same way about my steaks. If I don't have a reason, then I'm not going to do it. And so I typically don't. I think you're just adding. You know, the thing about it is, you know, if I see a snake that has mites and I'm going to take a spray bottle and spray down his entire enclosure and spray him with it, I might need to do that. But you think that snake's really happy that I'm in his enclosure with a spray bottle with something with alcohol in it spraying in his face?
No.
Probably not.
It's probably nothing, right? Please.
So you're, I mean, we're just adding stress to him. So you just got there. You just set him up in a brand new enclosure. He's already stressed. Now we're sticking our hands in the cage, spraying him in the face with some alcohol. You know, I just, unless you need it, I just don't think.
Okay. Now, what about as far as are you cleaning the rack down with the same stuff, with the frontline stuff? Do you recommend doing that, or are you just kind of doing the enclosure?
I never have seen a need for that. I see a fair number of animals with mites in my practice, and I always recommend it frontline, and I don't hear people coming back and saying what I'm recommending doesn't work, or the other mites are coming back. So I just typically, I just don't think it's necessary. I mean, I'm sure that if you were able to look at every square millimeter of your rack, there'd be something on the rack. But typically, if you got mites, they don't really have much reason to leave the area where a snake is. Now, if you take the snake out, let's say if you have a snake that has mites, and then you take him out of there, then the mites are going to be crawling around looking for somewhere to go. But typically, if the snake's in there, they're not going to be leaving looking for somewhere to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess.
That's another reason why I say, I think when you're treating mites, it's best if you're treating something that treats the environment to leave everything as it is. You're going to take the water bowl out because the snakes don't want to drink it, no matter what product you're using, whether it's fipronil or pyrethrin or whatever it is. You don't want them to drink it. But whatever, to take the water bowl out and leave everything as it is. Because what I don't want to do is stir up the environment so that those mites start going crawling around looking for something. You definitely don't want to take the snake out of there. So then they're going to go looking for a meal. And then they just...
So basically leave them put and kill them while they're on the snake that you see them on.
Okay. It's secret warfare.
Leave bait and then
them
get them.
That's right. Kill them with our brain and nuclear fipronil.
Does it make a difference that if you're using newspaper as opposed to like a bedding?
I think it probably does. A lot of people like to use bedding. I use newspaper for everything. I say for everything. I've got three green tree pythons and I've got three jungle carpet pythons. I use mulch in those cages. Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to really think about it. I mean, it does help keep the humidity up a little bit in those cages. Typically, I just think it looks better in those arboreal cages, so that's kind of why I do it.
Sure.
So I do think newspaper makes mites much easier to treat. There's no doubt about that. And, there's no doubt about it because there's less places for them to hide. It's easier when you go to treat it. Think about it, the surface area of mulch or pine shavings or something like that, the surface area of that stuff is tremendous. And so you're not going to, when you spray it, you're not going to get on the underside of every little pine shaving. You're going to sort of rely on those mites to crawl around and crawl through whatever you spray on there. You know, when you got newspaper, you pretty much got the underside and the top side. And so you don't have to worry about that. You know, it's just easier. But.
Makes sense. So I guess the next one would be stomatitis mouth rot.
Yeah.
So what is mouth rot, and what are some of the signs that we can look for? Because I've heard it has a certain smell to it, actually.
Oh, see, this is probably the most complicated of the subjects that you picked to talk about. Because there's so much terminology that gets misused, you might say. We use the word stomatitis. Stomatitis is a big, all-encompassing word, and it just means inflammation of the mucosa of the mouth, right? So it could be, there's a tons of different problems that can be stomatitis. When you say mouth rot, it truthfully, I mean, there really isn't a medical definition of the term mouth rot. Usually what that means is somebody's describing what they see, and that means that they're seeing something that looks like the mouth is rotten. But that can be a ton of different things, right? It could be an infection. It could be trauma. It could be a tumor. It could be, an injury of some sort. Just lots of different things that can look like mouth rot. So I think most people, the reason that that becomes important is because most people see what they think is mouth rot and they automatically assume stomatitis, it's some kind of infection. The thing is, it might not be.
Okay.
If we just talk about the general term stomatitis, so, you know, what are we talking about? Infectious stomatitis is the thing that we're all talking about. It's not always what is the real diagnosis, but that's what we seem to always be talking about. So what is infectious stomatitis? It's an infection in the mouth. And that is so like the respiratory problems. It can be viral. It can be fungal. It can be bacterial. It could be, if it's infectious, those are the main things. The thing is, infectious stomatitis, a true infection in the mouth is, I won't say never, but almost never is it a primary disease. So you look at a snake and you see an infection in the mouth and go, oh, he's got stomatitis. So we'll give him some antibiotics and that'll fix the problem. That's usually not the end of the story because something else is causing that stomatitis.
Okay.
It could be lots of different things. Like I said, it could have started with trauma. It could have started with a tumor. It could have started with a respiratory infection. But stomatitis just by itself is rarely a primary problem.
Okay.
I see a fair number of cases of stomatitis. I'd say probably that's the second most common thing that I see. By now, most people have got... The thing is, it's difficult now, maybe not as much as it has been in the past, but it's really difficult to get people to bring their snakes to the vet to start with.
Really?
I think a couple of things are complicating that issue. One is there's not a lot of good reptile veterinarians out there. And to be fair, I'm not even a reptile veterinarian. I'm just a regular veterinarian. I'm not board certified in exotic animal medicine. But I've been keeping them since 1988 or 9, and I just happen to know more about them than most people. And when I went to vet school, I started with the motivation to learn about them. So even though Auburn is not, they don't have a great exotic program. If you just go there and go through the core curriculum and you just take what you get, you don't get a lot. But if you have a special interest in it, they'll pretty much do whatever you want them to do. So they'll teach you whatever you want to teach if you have an interest in it. So I started from the very beginning wanting to learn. So I went through and actually learned quite a bit about reptile medicine, even though it wasn't what they intended on teaching me.
Right.
But people read stuff on the internet, and for the last 50 years, you know, the common perception is, well, I can take my snake to the vet, but he's not going to know any more about it than I do. And for a long time, that's been true. You take a snake to a vet, and he wants to help. He wants to do the best he can, but all he knows is dog and cat medicine. And so, you know, he does the best he can, but it's not the same, right?
Right.
If you don't know the husbandry, 99% of the problem you can't help with, because that's 99% of the problems we see.
Right.
I got off track. What were you asking me?
No. You're okay. Still on it. So now I've heard that mouth rot can come about from an upper respiratory infection where the phlegm or the mucus will cough up and get caught in the snake's teeth and then rot the mouth from that.
I don't know if I would necessarily agree exactly with that, but the primary issue I think is true. So there's a really common misconception that an infectious stomatitis can cause a respiratory infection. So a snake starts with a problem in his mouth and causes a respiratory infection, that almost never happens. But what does happen a lot of times is a snake will have a respiratory infection, and it will progress to the point where it causes an inflammation or an infectious stomatitis. That happens quite a bit. That's why I was saying at the beginning of this, if we see an infection in the mouth, we need to be looking for something else. And a lot of times it's a respiratory infection. A lot of times a snake will have some sort of either tracheitis or pneumonia or something like that, and it will have progressed because it hasn't been treated. It will progress to an infectious stomatitis. I don't know if I would say I really agree that a snake is coughing up phlegm. I mean, to start with, they don't really cough. They don't have a diaphragm. So they can't really cough. I mean, we do see them wheezing sometimes, and sometimes they can wheeze pretty violently. I would say it almost sounds like a cough. So they can wheeze pretty violently and wheeze some stuff out. But the true pathology or the true physiology of that, so it's something getting caught in the snake's teeth and then rotten, I kind of doubt that. I think it's just a matter of it coughs something up, there's bacteria in it, the bacteria stays in the mouth, and now it has an infection in its mouth.
Okay. So now what are some of the ways you can treat mouth infection?
Yeah, I think treatment of mouth infectious stomatitis is kind of like what we were talking about before. So we've got to find the problem and treat the problem. I usually don't typically just go right after treatment and infectious stomatitis. I want to find the problem and treat that, and then usually the stomatitis will go away. Now, if it's really bad, like we've got some really bad ulcers in the mouth, or we got some open mucosa that's open and draining or something, sometimes we'll flush that out with something, like chlorhexidine solution or some antibiotic solution or something like that. But typically, to just say snake has an infection in his mouth, let's treat it, usually I'll say, okay, well, let's find out what happened to this snake. Because he has a respiratory infection. If he does, let's fix that, and then his mouth problem will go away. Has he been kept on aspirin bedding, and he got a big chunk of aspirin stuck in his gums and split his gum open, and it got infected that way? Okay, well, let's take this snake off of his aspirin, get this aspirin out of his mouth, maybe flush it out with a little chlorhexidine or some antibiotic solution or something like that, fix his problem, and his mouth problem will go away.
Okay.
So we see sometimes we'll see, doesn't happen in snakes all that much, but see some lizards that have actually broken jaws or something. We'll see some, metabolic bone disease or some trauma or something like that. Snake will actually have a broken jaw and a bone will stick through his gum or something like that. They can get an infection like that too.
Okay. Now, I've heard of washing the mouth with the betadine, everything from betadine to hexidine, as you said, and even in some extreme cases, hydrogen peroxide. Would you suggest any of those?
Yeah. The only thing I'll ever use in the mouth is chlorhexidine. Betadine, not really friendly to mucosa, and so you can do it. If you dilute it, you can do it. I don't really see the need to. Since we have chlorhexidine is not that expensive. It's much better. It works better. It's easier on the mucosa, safer. I just use it. And I don't know that I ever see a need to use hydrogen peroxide in the mouth of the snake. I don't know that I'd ever see the need for it.
Okay. That works. So the next one would be dystocia, which is egg binding.
Egg binding.
I've actually lost a female to egg binding last year, and fortunately we didn't catch it soon enough. So what are some of the common thoughts? What are some of the causes from egg binding?
That is a pretty poorly understood disease, to be honest.
Really?
I don't know that anybody's ever really gotten to the bottom of what causes egg binding. I certainly there's some things we know will cause it. If a snake's had it before and he's either had surgery or he has some scar tissue from a previous problem, that'll cause it. Infections or anything that will cause problems in the reproductive tract, that causes some scar tissue or some stricture will cause it. So basically you got, I mean, we can separate it into two things. We can separate it into obstructive problems. So there's something in the way obstructing the eggs. It can either be a stricture or, like I said, scar tissue or a previous surgery site or a tumor or something in the way that the eggs physically can't pass by. And then there are non-obstructive diseases. You know, and that, those things can be infections. Where the actual reproductive tract won't move, or in some animals, I don't know if I haven't been right on top of the green tree python breeding thing, but I don't know if now that people have more data to deal with, if they still think this or not, but it used to be pretty commonly thought that some green tree pythons won't lay unless you give them an egg box or lay box. And I think that's true in some other species for sure. I always give mine a lay box, so I don't really know if they will or won't, but I was there. But I think the idea I'm getting at is some snakes won't. And so if you don't provide them somewhere to lay the eggs, they'll just sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait. And then eventually you get to the point where they just can't do it. But I don't know,
okay.
Like I said. Those are just some pretty vague things. I don't think anybody really has nailed it down, unless you see a problem like a tumor or scar tissue or something like that. I don't really know what caused it.
So when should we as a breeder start thinking or worrying that maybe a female could be egg-bound? Well, maybe she misses her due date or something like that?
Yeah, I think, one thing that gets important here is that a lot of breeders miss is good record keeping. Obviously, this happens more often in the early part of the life of the snake. So, the first year or two that a snake produces eggs, it's more likely to be egg bound than later on. But
right.
Good record keeping is good. So, if you've got a female that's laid, say, 4 years in a row and you've kept good records on her, then usually they follow the same pattern pretty much. And so if something's outside of normal for that snake, then I might get worried for her a little sooner than I would, you know, say, a snake that I don't have any history on or one that typically goes longer or something like that. The other thing is if you see the snake for some reason, you happen to see the snake physically trying to pass an egg and nothing's happening, that would be another reason to worry. Or if something doesn't look right. Oftentimes, what will happen if a snake tries to start passing some eggs, the eggs will begin to move down, and we've all seen that process happen, and then one egg passes, another one moves down. Well, what happens is one gets stuck, and the others keep moving down, so you end up with a great big bulge at the rear end of the snake. Instead of neat eggs lined up in a neat little row, you get a big bunch of things, you know, eggs back towards the back. That can happen. If you see something like that, that would obviously alert you to a problem.
Right. Okay.
What are some of the things that you? What would you typically do if a snake is egg bound?
Yeah. So, are we talking about now what I would do or what I would recommend somebody do at home?
Well, I guess there's steps you can take at home, but I would imagine that you would take. I mean, if my snake was egg bound, I would bring her to the vet. So, you know.
You'd be surprised how often that doesn't happen. Most of the egg bound animals that I see come to me after somebody's already tried to do something, and that makes my job way more difficult. But unfortunately, that's the way it is. But typically, if I would say this, if you're ever going to bring it to me, don't do anything. Just bring it to me because it's going to be much easier for me to deal with if you haven't already tried to do something.
Right.
But there's a couple of things. There's a couple of things that can be done. If somebody brings me a snake, in assessing the situation, sometimes I might decide that the best thing for that animal is for me to try to physically manipulate the egg out of the snake. I don't necessarily recommend somebody who doesn't know what they're doing to try that, because if you're too forceful with it, it means lots of things you can do. You can break an egg in there, and that's not good. You can tear something in the snake, and that's not good. There's lots of things that can go wrong with that. But there are times when I've done that and times when I thought that was the best approach. there's there are certain hormones that you can give to make reproductive tract more motile, or to stronger contractions and move things out. If there's some reason that I thought, let me just say that's written in the books and that's talked about, but I've never done that. I never really saw a situation where I thought that would work or that was what was needed. But there's certain drugs you can give them to try to help them pass in certain circumstances. There's always the possibility of aspirating the contents of an egg. And that can happen a couple different ways. That can be done through the skin, and that's what we call percutaneous ovocentesis. So we're sticking a needle through the skin into the egg and drawing out the contents of the egg into the syringe and making the egg physically smaller so that the snake can pass it out. And then sometimes you can either manually manipulate it out or the snake can pass it on its own. If the egg is close enough, you can actually go through the vent where you can see the egg, maybe even push it back a little bit where you can see it, and then go directly into the egg and not have to go through the skin. I prefer that if it's possible. Sometimes most eggs aren't back far enough to do that with, but if they are, you can actually pull right into the egg and draw that stuff out of there. And then obviously there's surgery. We can do surgery to remove the eggs.
And,
that's not my favorite thing to do. But.
Let me ask you this. What are the, as far as, what is the likelihood, if at all, that female would be able to breed again if she was egg bound?
The surgery or just egg binding?
Just egg binding.
Yeah.
So typically what I tell people is if the snake has surgery, I don't recommend breeding them again. If I've had snakes, my own personal snakes that I've done it with, and I've done surgery, and those snakes have been able to have eggs, to lay eggs normally later. But I can tell you it happens more often the other way than that. So, and this is, I don't know any veterinary surgeon who's done surgery on snakes who has a good success rate of doing surgery on snakes and then having them later on be able to pass eggs normally. It happens. And I'm sure there's somebody out there that has a really good success rate that I'm just not aware of. I'm not saying nobody does, but I'm not aware of anybody. Just most of the time, if they have surgery, I recommend not breeding. Not impossible, but just usually more often than not, they'll have problems. If we can get that egg out of there with a reasonably small amount of stress to the snake, I usually tell people, it depends. Is this the first time that the snake's been egg-bound? If this is her first year, this is the first time she's been egg-bound, next year she's going to be probably bigger than she is now. A whole new thing. We haven't damaged anything. Try to breed her again. If she does it next year, don't do it anymore. Is this the third year in a row she's been egg-bound? Regardless, I'm going to say probably just don't do this anymore.
Right.
So, it just depends on the situation. But typically, if it's just once and it's early in the life of the snake, so she's, what species we're talking about. She's 2-3 years old. This is her first season. She gets egg-bound. She's got one egg in there, and we can get it out pretty easy with a little stress to the snake. I usually say, try it again. Give her a year off or do it again next year. Try it one more time. If she egg binds again, then, retire. If she goes normal, then good to go.
Okay. And do you find that, I know I don't really, I follow ball python somewhat, but isn't it the desert ball python has the problem with the females laying eggs?
Yes.
Is that really what's going on there type of thing?
That's a show by itself. In fact, CK, I don't know if you guys know who CK is, constrictor keeper on the Bush League. He and I actually did a reptile radio show on deserts. We're talking about that. So I've got a couple of desert females here at my house that were given to me by John Willard, and the purpose he gave them to me for was so I could try to work on it a little bit and see if I could come up with anything. That's gone pretty slow. I haven't really had enough time to do much, but I've done a couple of things, and the truth is nobody has the answers to that yet. I've got some ideas. I've talked to a couple of people that have some ideas too, and we've seen a few things. So I'm going to be working on it a little bit in the next few years, but it's going to take a while, and I honestly doubt that anybody's going to come up with an answer to that problem. it's going to be, if they do, it's going to be exceedingly difficult. I can tell you just in my own personal opinion where I think the problem is, but you're going to get 50 people that are way smarter than I am. They're going to disagree with me, so I'm not sure it matters much. I think the problem is in development. I think the females are having a problem in the development of their brain while they're still in the egg, and it's making them non-viable reproductively. So that's just what I think. I think that part of their brain is not developing, and they just can't produce the hormones that they need to reproduce. Males do fine.
Huh.
The males do perfectly fine. They don't have the problem. And I don't know if that's because it's a different part of the brain. I'm not sure. I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of the problem. Part of the problem is, I think, in order to prove my theory right, we're going to have to sacrifice a bunch of snakes. And
right.
Although that may become necessary, it may become a viable study one of these days, it's not going to be something that we're going to do just, you know, I'm not just going to throw a bunch of snakes together and kill a bunch of them and send them to a lab and say, hey, check these out for me. It's going to have to be a real closely monitored study where the animals are humanely euthanized, and you know, that's a big deal. That's not something you just try out and say, you know, here's what we found. But in the meantime, I do have these two girls here, and I'm going to be doing some blood work on them and comparing them to some normal girls that I have here and some other morph girls that I have here. And at some point, I haven't committed to it. At some point, I may either do surgery on these snakes and remove their entire reproductive tract and have it looked at by a pathologist, or I may euthanize the snakes and have them sent to a pathologist and necropsy and compared to some normal. Another normal, but we already know what a normal snake looks like. But that may happen one of these days. I haven't really decided how I'm going to do that yet. One thing is not going to happen here. We're not going to try to breed any desert females, because we already know it's not going to work.
Right. So then you would, is it prone to be a genetic thing, I guess?
Well,
I mean, I know
it
is with the desert, but I'm just saying in general with pythons.
I mean, we've got some specific examples. You know, we've got spider wobble. We've got some lethal combinations in ball pythons with the homozygous spiders, spider champagnes. There's some other lethal combinations. I think you guys even have a couple of lethal combinations in carpet pythons, huh?
The jag.
Jag
is like spider.
I think. What now?
A jag is like a spider. It got the wobble, and then if you breed them together, you get dead white one.
I think we have some specific examples of some hereditary things, but I don't know if we can get to the point where we can say overall that infertility is genetic in snakes. I don't think we can go that far, but we do have those specific examples where it's true.
Okay. All right, very good. We're coming down on time, but I wanted to hit on this question before we get on to what you got going on as far as quality serpents. As far as cleaning, I know this wasn't on our outline, but can you maybe give us some tips as far as what you would use to clean, you know, your enclosures, and what we can do to make sure that we're obviously, it's not going to be sterile, but we want it to be a relatively clean enclosure.
Yep. So here is the number one subject that's gotten me in trouble in the past. So,
right.
I'll give you my opinion, and
very good.
Nobody's going to like it.
Awesome.
I'll tell you what I do, and I know other people who do it the same way. And what I always say is what I said before. In nearly 25 years now keeping snakes, never had a case of respiratory infection in my collection. But I'm pretty sure that I'm doing a pretty good job of keeping things clean. So here's basically what I do. I clean my tubs with water and hot water. And when there's something dirty in the cage, I use a little bit of Ivory soap or Dawn dishwater soap, and I clean that out. And I use a toothbrush. I use a toothbrush to clean the tub out, and I get it really clean. And I use hot water, and I dry it out, and I put the snake back in it. Once a year, I will take all my tubs out, and I'll take them out, and obviously not all of them at the same time because I don't have doubles for every snake, but I'll take them out and wash them out really good with soap and water, and I'll put a 1 to 10 bleach solution in it and let it sit for a little while and take it and pour it out, rinse it out really good, and take it out done and let it dry, and then I bring it back in the house and put the snakes back in it. And that amounts to every bit of what I do to keep my snakes clean. And I personally, I never use any kind of solution. I don't use chlorhexidine solution. I don't use any kind of quaternary ammonium product. I don't use any bleach other than that once a year. And the reason I do the once a year bleach thing is not for sterility. It's for to make my tubs look good because it gets a little discolored over time. So just to help with it. Make them look better. I don't use any kind of quaternary ammonium product. I don't use any bleach products. I don't use any chlorhexidine or anything like that. Just soap and water. So I don't have a problem with people using those other products for the most part. I'm not a big fan of quaternary ammonium products. There's a lot of quaternary ammonium products out there. I tell you, F10 is the one that got me in trouble. I didn't really call out the people that make F10, but F10 is a quaternary ammonium product. And when I wrote the article on the Bush League, the F10 people didn't like that very well and wrote some nasty stuff about me. But
really?
Yeah. So the reason that they're really, really bad about being inactivated in the presence of organic material. So, and that goes for all the quaternary ammonium products. What's an organic material? Well, feces and urates are organic material. Mm-hmm. So if you clean it out first and then you use a quaternary ammonium product or bleach is the same way. At the concentrations that we normally use of that, it's pretty much inactivated in the presence of organic material. So it doesn't help you with antibacterial or antimicrobial cleansing. Quaternary ammonium products can be decent cleaners. That's the thing. We've got to separate these products into cleaning and disinfecting. Some products are good cleaners. Some are good disinfectors. Some are both. I believe F10 specifically has some of those products, I believe, don't hold me to this, but I believe some have soap products in them too, so they're good. So they're cleaners and disinfectors.
Okay.
And there are a couple of other products out there that are sort of like that, have a soap in them and a quaternary ammonium product, so they're cleaners and disinfectors. I'm a big cleaner, not a big disinfector. I just really don't think it's necessary. There have been a couple of studies, and I quoted a couple of studies in the article that I wrote on the Bush League. Anybody wants to go look it up, they can look it up and see the study that I quoted. But there have been a couple of studies that sort of indicate that some quaternary ammonium products, if you have a respiratory infection, using quaternary ammonium products, I don't ever recommend that. And the reason is because of the studies that I quoted in there. The studies that I quoted showed that if somebody was using a quaternary ammonium product in the face of a respiratory infection, it took about 10 times the amount of antibiotics to kill that respiratory infection.
Jesus.
And so I would encourage anybody that wants to go back and read that study and read why that's the case and all that, but the study's there and it does exist and it's true stuff. So I'm not just making it up. But they didn't like that very well. They got mad. Neither here nor there. My point is, I don't use any product. So I don't even use chlorhexidine. I love chlorhexidine. I use it in my office all the time. So I use to prep my surgeries with. Use what I use to prep my hands before surgeries. What I clean all my surfaces with. I do all that. Now, having said that, too, I also use a quaternary ammonium product in my office to clean our kennel.
Right.
We use a product that's called Local D. child, and it's primarily a quaternary ammonium. It has a soap in it, so it's a cleaner and a disinfectant, but it has a quaternary. Its primary ingredient is quaternary ammonium product. But we don't use that until we clean everything first. It's really important you clean things. You clean it with soap and water first, and then you put those quaternary ammonium products on there and kill some viruses and bacteria. But for my money, I want chlorhexidine. If I'm going to disinfect something, I'm going to use chlorhexidine. Just, I think it's safer. It's more effective. It's not inactivated when it touches the organic material. It works better. That's where my money is.
Awesome. Well, at least now I'm going to start using hot water. Anyway, before we cut off here real quick, Shane, can you tell us about Quality Serpents? What's going on with you guys over there?
Yeah. I gave myself a business name about 3 years ago, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been a big breeder. Don't really ever intend on being a big breeder. But I started a website a couple of years ago, gave myself a business name, and started acting more like a business a few years ago, and I named it Quality Serpents. It really wasn't anything different than what I've been doing before, except for I just started acting like a business. I started taking credit cards and, you know, running a website and putting things on Facebook and that kind of thing. But it's pretty much just an extension of what I've always been doing. Primarily, I've always been a colubrid breeder.
Mm-hmm.
So our biggest focus is corn snakes and milk snakes. I've got about, I'd say about 60 breeders, colubrids. We've got, like I said, I've got three green tree pythons, one male and two females. I've got the same jungle carpet pythons, a male and two females, and a few ball pythons here and there. That's pretty much it. Most of my collection is corn snakes and milk snakes. Got quite a few color phases and pattern phases of corn snakes. Right now, a good friend of mine, we talked about a minute ago, CK, Constrictor Keeper, from the Bushland.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
He lives in Long Island, New York, and his house was pretty much destroyed by Hurricane Sandy. So he was struggling for a place, and I just, at the time, I happened to have pretty recently built some new racks and had plenty of place to keep it, and so I told him to bring his stuff to my house. So he loaded it all up in the truck and brought me his ball python collection.
Oh, that's nice of you.
Yeah.
And so I'm keeping that, and while he's building his house back and getting back on his feet. So I've got a lot of ball pythons here right now breeding, and I'm trying to keep his breeding season alive for him and to do the best I can with that. So right now, my collection is a lot bigger than it usually is. But that stuff will be going back with him pretty soon.
Awesome. You get a little taste of the ball pythons for a little bit then, I guess.
It really kind of spoiled me. I told you before, a friend of mine that got me started in ball pythons, or got me started in snakes, we bred some ball pythons way back then, probably '89 or '90. And there weren't very many people breeding ball pythons back then. But up until now, that was about the extent of my ball python stuff. We worked at it really hard because we wanted to figure it out. And after we did it a couple of times, we just kind of left off with it, and I never got back into it. But man, since I've had them here, I've forgotten how hard my colubrid stuff is to take care of. It's hard to, and I'm constantly cleaning and feeding, and breeding season for me is horrendous. I don't know. I'm a little meticulous and crazy OCD about things, and so I don't leave my snakes together. I put them together and let them breed, and then I'll separate them and move them back. So I spend a lot more time than probably I should during breeding season. But these ball pythons, man, it's easy stuff here. It's like just living the easy life for that.
Nice.
So, Shane, what's your website in case people want to get in touch with you, check out what you guys got going on over there?
Yeah, it's www.qualityserpents.com.
All right.
Facebook,
so they can...
Facebook page is the Quality Shepherds.
Excellent. So they can just give you a call or shoot you an email if they find something they like.
Yeah, and one thing that's on that website that a lot of people like and a lot of people use, there's a page on there that's called Ask the Doctor. And so basically you just type in a question and it'll shoot it to me in email. And usually I try to get back to people pretty quick, a day or so. But it's just a place for, it's free. So I don't charge anybody for it. I just do it because I enjoy doing it. People, you know, got a problem with a snake or some other kind of reptile or whatever, and they get on there and shoot me a question, and I try to do my best and help out with those things. It's a little bit, it limits a little bit. There's only so much you can do over the internet. You know, sometimes I can have them send me pictures or videos or something like that, but still, you're limited in what you can do. And legally, I'm limited in what I can do, so I can't really prescribe medication over the internet, that kind of stuff. But still, especially with husbandry things, a lot of times we can get some resolution to some things that way. But a lot of people seem to like that feature, and I enjoy keeping it up. So it's there if anybody wants to use that. Feel free to do that.
And then you said you had some of the articles that you wrote are over on the Bush League Breeders Club.
Yeah.
And that's what, reptileradio.net, right?
Yep, reptileradio.net.
Okay, yep.
That's a great one. And I'm on there every day. And so people ask questions on there, and I try to help out with those things over there, too. A lot of those articles are on my website too. I don't think they all are on there yet, but a lot of them are on there too.
Okay, awesome. Well, there's still some topics that we wanted to hit on, so we'd love to have you on and keep it going with talking to you. It was really awesome talking to you and getting your perspective, and appreciate all your help that you've given us.
I enjoyed it. Feel free to call me and use me anytime you want.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot for coming on, and you have a good night, all right?
Oh, thanks for having me. You guys have a good night, too.
Give us a call to you soon.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Bye, you too.
All right, there we go, Dr. Shane Whitaker. A lot of information there, and it's something that one of those shows to go back and listen to, topic by topic, and really break it down. And I would definitely recommend taking advantage if you have a question that from the show or just a question in general. Go over to QualitySerpents.com, and I'll put the link over on our Facebook page, so you can check that out, and also would be on the webpage, so you can go over there and if you have a question or you just want to see what's going on as far as what he has going on. Let's see, I guess before we jump off, anything you wanted to hit on now?
You got to do the rundown.
The rundown. Yeah.
The list of things we do at the end of this. How do you not know this by now?
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, we got to be approaching our 100th episode. At least it feels like it.
Yeah, we're up there. So I guess the first order of business is this Saturday in Hamburg, PA, Reptile Show in Hamburg. You're going to have the Northeast Coalition of Reptile or Carpet Python.
Dear mother of God, if you wanted to go to a reptile show and you're a carpet enthusiast, this is the one to go to if you can't make it to Chicago. Because on one side of the aisle, you'll have me splitting a table with Ben from Australian Edition, and then I'll have Eric floating around. I mean, that's just he's there but not there. So Eric will be there. And then about an aisle or two the other way, you have the little mini carpet row, which is Howard from Reading Reptile Breeders, Mo from Mojo Reptiles, and Jason Balin from East Coast Serpents. And they're all in a row. So basically you've got 5.5 breeders that are all there.
Yeah.
Sorry, buddy, you're the half. So,
is it because I'm short or what?
I'm going to let you paint that any way you want.
All right, fair enough.
You'll have all those breeders there.
and you're going to have a, there's going to be a very, very big representation of the carpet python. I know that Ben is bringing some of the stuff that he's been doing with Aussie Addiction. I know I'm bringing my caramels, Jags, things like that, as well as some of the pythons that we've been kind of deciding to let go. And, of course, Eric will be there. Unfortunately, though, he cannot bring any Arian Jays with him. They've been outlawed from the table. I apologize. Customers that of Eric's, that shit will not fly. Anyway.
I guess what I would throw out there is I'm going to try to – I have a few calendars left to see if anybody wants – Again, anything that I would go as far as say this: if you the first person that comes up to the table, and if I'm not there, I'll give it to you, Owen. But the first person that comes up to the table and says that they listen to the show, we'll give them a free calendar. How about that?
Can we sign it too to make ourselves seem really awesome?
Yeah, I guess so. If you want to do that, but sure. You know, I would go at, you know, no offense to you, Owen, but I would go just to give a chat with Ben from Australian Addiction. I chat with you all the time, so it's no big deal.
You're the kind of asshole that sends me pictures of, look what just came in this box. I'm like, what is,
So, yeah, it should be cool. You know, I kind of get a little excited when I see shows are not going to just be, you know, wall pythons, and I, you know, like I said, I just like seeing the different snakes at the shows, whether it's
it is good. Something
pythons, yeah, pythons, colubrids, just, you know, those species that you don't see all the time, and I think that's a cool thing. So yeah, if you're there, if you're around, you're looking for something to do Saturday, definitely go and you know, check it out, and we'll be there.
So the rules for this calendar thing.
there's never rules up when we just fly by the seat of our band.
Rules, Chris just texted me. He says, I want a calendar. I'm going to be the first one to say it to him.
No. He doesn't count. I'm talking about an actual listener. No prior guests. How about that?
No prior.
I'll trade him a calendar for a How My Hair Scrub. How about that?
You can have Alan when you pry it from his cold, dead hands.
Well,
maybe. I don't know. But anyway. But, yeah, that's going on Saturday. If you are in the area, it's just a good time. I definitely recommend coming out. You know, what's really funny is that you have Hamburg Saturday, and then apparently White Plains is Sunday. So, yeah, that's at least what I thought it was on the calendar. It's what I've been reading on the Facebooks, is that White Plains is actually Sunday. So it looks like some of the breeders are going to be doing back-to-back. So,
also, too, if you're not in the Northeast area and you're down in Texas area, I think the NARBC show – I said that wrong again. NARBC show – we'll be down there, and our good friend Sean Christensen will be down there.
The NRA show? That's not this radio show, buddy.
No. Yeah, the North American Reptiles Breeder Conference. How about that?
There we go. See, just don't try to just shorten it. Just say it.
Exactly. So, yeah, he'll be there, and that's going to be good. And check him out there, and he did post up a link. He's doing a. I just want to throw this out there for him. He did post up a link that he's doing a working out and trying to get in shape and such. And on that, he is. If you go over and like his page or like that post, which I did put over on my Facebook page, Eric Burke. You can. He's going to donate $500 to leukemia. I think that I read that right. Did you see that one?
Yeah, I did see that.
Okay. So yeah, go over there, like his page, and check it out and see what's going on. I will remind people again about the Rico Walder. Make sure you go over, do what you can, www.giveforward.com/Rico Relief Effort. What else do we have? You can check out Morelia Python Radio at www.moreliapythonradio.com. And I'm going to update that tonight so that all that information is over there. And don't forget, I have that Zebra Jag, $1,500 shipped. That will go all, every single penny will go to Rico's Relief Fund. You get a cool snake, and at the same time, we get to help out a fellow herper. So it's good all around. Morelia pick of the week. That just seems to be growing and growing and growing.
I love it.
it's just a cool thing, and I saw some cool stuff over there. I don't know if you saw that. Just on a side note, that striped tiger coastal that looked like it had all that diamond tipping in it and all.
Did you see the striped inland? Why are you talking about that? Just talk about the striped inland. I want to talk about the striped. Thank you. God damn it. You're like, I can't talk about it. I have four. Shut up.
I wouldn't say that. Not yet, anyway.
Of course not. Yeah.
So. What else do I have? I think Buddy Buscemi will not be on next week, but he'll be on the following week.
I have to talk about Buddy for what some of the things he said in that feed about Carpet Fest. Something about the better half of Rogue Reptiles will be at Carpet Fest, and then we're going to be walking away with green trees or some sort of Caranta. We're going to talk. Buddy and I got to talk. I don't know what he meant by that.
I think he meant me.
Shut the hell up.
I'm not the better half of Rogue Reptiles, but I'm
No, you're not.
I'm not any part of Rogue Reptiles.
No, you're not. At least not yet. I haven't assimilated you yet. Anyway.
You know, hey, man, I'll be walking away with the Chondro. Screw you. I know a good thing when I see it. So,
okay.
So that's so cool things there. Definitely come by, swing by, say hello at Hamburg this weekend. Check out MoreliaPythonRadio.com. If you have a question, comment, anything you'd like us to talk about, you can always drop an email at info@MoreliaPythonRadio.com. What else? EB Morelia, I guess. For me, breeding season is still trucking along. I'm not as far, way behind from last year, looking at records and such. So things are progressing now. So I hope that, we get some results soon. But we shall see. And, I think that's all I got. I think I'm – Carpet Fest. I can't forget that.
No, dear Lord.
Yeah. we got the two of them. We got the Northeast Carpet Fest, which is 5/18/2013, Waldorf, Maryland. You can go over to – we have a Facebook page for that and a website. The Facebook page basically we discuss different things that we are thinking about and ideas and what people are looking for, so it's a good time. Howard Redding, our good buddy, is sponsoring it, and he's opening his brand new kitchen and all the work that he did throughout the year, so that the Carpet Fest is top notch for us when we go there. That happens on 5/18, and like I said, we're going to be doing the auction like we did, maybe a little different, I think, this time. But we're going to be we're going to be raffling off animals, and all proceeds we're going to give to Rico, and I think that's a good cause. And like I said, Rico's a great guy, and I wish him nothing but the best. And it's a hell of a good time, man. It's really, really good.
Oh, dear Lord. I'm staying over because I have a wedding in Maryland that I have to go to the next day. So
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
Anyway. So.
And then the Seattle one, if you're over in the Northwest Carpet Fest, they're on 6-8-2013. And if you wanted to get in touch with anybody about that, contact Heather at nwheather7@yahoo.com.
Fantastic.
I think that's all I got.
So what I got is you can definitely check out rogue-reptiles.com for all the latest happenings of Rogue. You can also check out Rogue Reptiles on Facebook and get all the updates on our breeding season. It's looking like super caramels, tiger jaguars, and various tigers are on their way with the possibility of brettles, and I'm going to drown some granite aranjeas. I swear to Christ. Anyway, the other thing is that we also put up some animals to help out Rico. We have a 2012 male tiger from my Balin tiger male cross with my caramel female. He is not a caramel, but he is still a good-looking tiger. And then Chris has just offered up from Site B an adult male Jay up here, Barnack scrub, up for 400 again. With both of those animals, 100% of the proceeds will go to Rico. So I'll put up an ad on Rogue's Facebook page, and they'll both be at Hamburg this weekend. Definitely get in contact with me if you want any of the updates of any of the animals that we have for sale currently. Other than that, we'll see everybody Saturday. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll check everybody out next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.